Coming up in This Week in Computer Hardware, first impressions on the new iPad Pro. Is Bitcoin mining profitable again? Samsung's sick 49-inch ultra-wide display. And Alienware is even sicker, 240Hz G-Sync and FreeSync displays. And hey, it's the Xbox One X, people. All that and more coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twitch.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 419, recorded June 15th, 2017. NVIDIA rocks the Apple tax. Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch's weekly show that aims to bring you the most useful, most informative, most engaging, and yes, ladies and gentlemen, most delightful news and reviews about hardware. We love desktop. Boy, do we love desktops. We love mobile. We love handheld devices, phones, tablets, the Internet of Stuff. We're there for you. We're going to try to make your life buying hardware as little traumatic, as trauma-free as possible. Speaking of which, joining me now, Mr. Trauma-Free Hardware Lifestyle himself, PC Purr's very own, Ryan Shrout. Hey, man.
Never claim to be trauma-free in almost any regard, computer hardware or not.
I may have been tongue-in-cheek and slightly obnoxious in saying that, because you, like me, can honestly say that you have so many hardware answers because you've made so many hardware fails. Although, yeah. If I'm projecting on that one, please tell me to go stuff myself.
No.
You have the 10.5-inch iPad Pro, which I'm presuming you whipped out your credit card to pay for. And if
yeah,
you
no, Apple didn't
congratulations.
Send me
it. No. Okay. I was about to be super excited for you.
Absolutely not.
But I bring that up because I want to know, are you giving up Windows PCs in exchange for what I understand is the superior mobile computing platform that is the iPad Pro? Do you feel professional?
No. So far, I've done adult coloring books on the iPad Pro, so probably not on the adult scale. This is my first experience with the iPad Pro, and it really, I don't know what I'm doing with it, to be perfectly honest with you. We're going to do a review, clearly, and I'm going out of town next week, and I'm planning to take it with me and try to use it as my primary computing device for that couple of days of span, like taking notes and, you know, can I do news posts and that type of stuff from it. It's also interesting because it comes with iOS 10 on it still. And, you know, a lot of the improvements and benefits of the kind of productivity side of this platform comes with iOS 11. So I'm debating whether or not I want to put iOS 11 on there before I actually go on the trip or not. And I guess you can go back and forth. So if I need to do performance testing, A and B testing, that type of stuff, that might be there. I will say, like, from a hardware perspective, things are fast, but it's a brand new tablet, so I would expect nothing less. The 120Hz refresh on the screen is pretty nice. You can definitely see a difference looking at an older iPad Pro and this one, that, like, scrolling through things, scrolling down a website definitely looks better, smoother. I don't know what that nets me in terms of usability necessarily yet. Sure. It's just, you know, it's just looks nicer. It's, why do people get 144Hz monitors? You know, there are benefits other than gaming, and smoothness and responsiveness is it. You don't have a mouse cursor to move around, but as you interact with the screen with your pencil or the finger or whatever, there's some advantages to it. It's also my first experience using the Apple Pencil, which is an incredibly expensive device for what I thought it would cost. $99 for this little guy. So far, you know, like I said, I literally just got it in this morning, and I've been using OneNote and taking notes for my other testing that I'm doing and trying to interact with it. And while I legitimately was doing adult coloring books, it was all in service of seeing how the pencil works and how quickly the screen is, responsive to the pen. But so far, it's nice. I mean, I'm not going to get rid of my Windows machine for it. That's for sure. Well, I don't want to say for sure, but I will say highly, highly unlikely.
Highly, highly unlikely. So So, but it feels nice. Excellent build quality. You know, yes. It's working for you in that sense. So we wait. Perhaps by the time you come back from the trip, you will be all iPad Pro all the time.
I'll definitely have a more extended opinion, if nothing else.
We would expect nothing less. Something I wanted to add, the more time I work with that 8K Dell UltraSharp, which I will in the near future have to send back to Dell, which is a little bit of a heartbreaker. You know that feeling where just when you start to really enjoy a piece of hardware, you have to send it back. The thing that really has struck me is not so much the 8K resolution in terms of the massive desktop, but how much I really like the little tiny pixels, right? That sort of, while we're talking about Apple, that Retina display idea that, you know, if you increase number of pixels per inch high enough, you end up with, you know, the Retina display idea that you know, it's particularly rich, sumptuous. I don't know what words to use to describe this, but I got to say that the 8K monitor for me is less about 8K and more about me being fascinated with how good everything looks on this screen, in part because the pixels are so small. More so than with the ultra wide monitors I've been using. I also had a couple questions on Twitter where people are like, well, why didn't, you know, Dell do this as an ultra wide monitor? And it's like, well, because a lot of people work with content in 16:10, or maybe the panels are only available in 16:10 or 16:9. I apologize. I should have calculated to make sure I had the right ratio there, but you know, not everybody likes the expansive super wide panel. And, you know, mm-hmm. That said, I wouldn't be surprised if panels in the future increase the resolution. Although for the gaming market, I think they want higher refresh rates, more so they want higher resolution. For professional markets, I can see where, and actually for a lot of end users, I think as, you know, GPU power becomes more affordable, we'll start to see more of these incredibly dense monitors in terms of the pixels per inch. But I just wanted to mention that because I've been thinking about that a lot. So I'll use my monitor at home, which is fantastic. And then I'll come here and I'll be like, oh, this feels so luxurious. It's, you know, it's, I don't know. It's an interesting thought, not a particularly, you know, deep thought, but the pixel density is really compelling. And in my case, it's really been growing on me. Also, Dell UltraSharps are fantastic on color, which is why I've owned like three of them in my life. So. Cryptocurrency Revisited. Let's talk about mining. Ken Anderson wrote this up for PC Per. Just when you think mining is dead, it's back. Or we should say,
yeah, maybe Bitcoin it's dead again. You never know.
Really? It could be dead, could be alive. Well, part of the issue, right, was that it got to the point where the computational power was so intense, the only people that could really get anything out of cryptocurrency mining were people who had, you know, Bitcoin farms, essentially, or whatever their cryptocurrency of choice was, where they had zillions of GPUs, you know, running constantly to the tune of incredible electric and AC bills. What was Ken thinking about as he wrote this one up?
So, I mean, the impetus behind the story was basically because of that Ethereum is kind of like the new hot cryptocurrency that people are building on. It's kind of got the highest return rates. It takes advantage of GPU computing again, like Bitcoin did in its early days. It's kind of been a revival. I mean, we kind of started taking a look at it, honestly, because of the stocking issues of AMD's Radeon graphics cards, right? So when we noticed you couldn't find 480s or 580s anywhere, it was like, oh, is this really a thing again? And you go in and you start to do some research and you look at the communities and you see what they're doing and investing in, and clearly it has been. And it's all driven on the value of these currencies, right? So if you look at something like, and I say this very deliberately, that on an hourly basis, these things change dramatically. Like right now, the Bitcoin price is at $2,319. A week ago, it was as high as $2,998 or $2,997. Actually, I think it got to $2,999.01. Before it started falling down again. And when the values of these are high, then the compute cycles of your GPUs become worth more, and you can pay off those cards quicker. So people would go out and buy cards specifically for this purpose. And we've seen this happening back in 2009, 10, saw it again in like 2013 when like Litecoin came out. Now we're just kind of seeing a revival of it as another cryptocurrency comes out. But now, because it's interesting, because if you look at, went back and looked at the story we did 7 years ago, and Bitcoin was worth $14. And right. So the big discussion was, is it worth, like, how much do you, what kind of cards can even use less energy cost than they could possibly earn in cryptocurrency, right? And so that was the debate. Now it's not really a problem. Like when prices were at, you know, Bitcoins were $2,500, $2,700, you're looking at, even on the higher performing cards like the 1080 Ti, where a 10%, maybe you're spending 10% on power and electric, you know, and cooling for your home, you know, changes that might come into play. And so it was a highly profitable thing. And as things, values go down, obviously that all readjusts. So it's from a PC hardware standpoint, it's more interesting in that, how does this affect AMD and NVIDIA? How does this affect gamers, right? Because the disappointing part is, if you're a PC gamer, you can't go buy the $200 or $235 RX 580 anymore, which if you're AMD, you kind of look at it and go, well, a sale is a sale. It's fine if you're an AMD board partner, sale is a sale. But if I think in the long term, if you're AMD, you have two concerns with that. One is, you're not getting people into your Radeon gaming ecosystem. So somebody who goes out to buy a $250 video card goes, oh, well, can't buy any 580s. I guess I'll buy a 1060. So now, even though AMD has sold cards, that person is now in the NVIDIA market. Right now they're going to like look at G-Sync monitors, they're going to install GeForce Experience, and they're going to, you know, start down that community road as opposed to the Radeon community road. The other problem is, at some point when this becomes a less popular thing to do, whether it be these new cryptocurrencies become less cost efficient to mine for GPUs, whatever it happens to be, you get this flood of used hardware back onto the market through eBay and Amazon resellers and whatever. So then whatever AMD is releasing then, or NVIDIA for that matter,
it's undermined, no pun intended.
Yeah. Yeah, interestingly enough.
By
the other product. And we saw it happen in 2009-10, and we saw it happen in 2013 again. And there's no doubt that it will occur again. It's just a matter of when. And it's even before, it was kind of only really the AMD parts that were I don't want to say suffering, but were impacted by this. Now it's even NVIDIA cards. Like if you look at the GTX 1070, it is a good balance of performance and cost. And you start to see those prices are going up, and they're harder to find at Amazon and Newegg. You know, people are buying 1080 Ti's because, you know, in theory, if the prices stayed where they were last week, you could buy a 1080 Ti and pay it off in just a little over 2 months. And then you could choose to stop and you got your graphic card for free, or keep going and, you know, have it mine in your downtime. It's an incredibly interesting thing that is incredibly volatile as well. And something like, I would not encourage people to actively buy hardware to do this. If you already have a 1080 or 1080 Ti and you're like, hey, this is interesting, and it's kind of like a hobby. Oh, I've got a couple of RX 580s, and hey, I'm out at work 10 hours a day. If I can mine for 10 hours a day and make me $8 or something like that while I'm gone, hey, you know, that's a couple hundred dollars a month. Great. You know, that type of stuff. But for people who are spending a lot of money on doing this, the fact that a cryptocurrency goes down, you know, 12% since yesterday, 20% since last week, like that's all impacting you. And if you don't have the resources to, you know, deal with that kind of volatility, it could be dangerous for investment, if nothing else.
Well, and let us be clear, the time to get in on any cryptocurrency is very early.
Because
the longer they run, the harder it is to grind out the coins, and the less effectively, the less money you make. So,
yep. The only other thing I'll say is, like, it has gotten exponentially easier to do it. Like, you basically can download one app, and it will benchmark your GPU and all these different algorithms and kind of accurately pick which is the most efficient, you know, cost to performance ratio for you. And it will adjust on the fly if prices change and bids change on performance. So it's kind of interesting that how simple it's gotten, but doesn't really prevent the volatility from affecting people otherwise. So
don't plan on retiring from this. unless you're really good at math and spreadsheets and stuff. Boy, I was down at E3 for a day, and boy, is that a crowded conference, and boy, are there a lot of lines if you want to play games. But some absolutely gorgeous games coming out, especially if you're on the PC. Ton of stuff coming out for the Switch. We talked about that a lot on Tech Thing this week. But hardware-wise, some of the big news was the Xbox One X, $499, smallest Xbox ever made, 6 teraflops of, if I got it right, 6 teraflops of GPU power, or 6 teraflops. Mm-hmm. They like saying teraflops in the most powerful console ever. To put that in the context of GTX 1080, is about 9 teraflops of power, and available November 7th, 2017. So, you know, they said sleek a lot, and they, you know, the big thing is, I got to say, Forza 7 Motorsport, 4K exclusive, Forza 7 Motorsport, Crackdown 3, State of Decay 2, Sea of Thieves, Super Lucky's Tale, are all meant to be played on Xbox One X. But I got to say, Forza Motorsport 7 looks unbelievably fantastic. The 12 gigabytes of GDDR5, a 6 teraflop GPU, 326 gigabytes per second memory bandwidth. They're really big on hammering specs with the idea that, we're better than PlayStation, 40% more power than any other console. Experience immersive true 4K gaming. Games play better on Xbox One X. Well, games all play pretty good on every console. They were really hammering speeds and feeds on this one. 8-core custom AMD CPU, clocked to 2.3 gigahertz. It's interesting. I'm also really curious to see whether or not anybody hacks into this to make it do things other than play video games. Just because there is a fair amount of power on tap for $500. The general consensus is that Microsoft is eating a fair amount of cash on the cost on these to get them in more of the households, as it were.
But there were a lot of discussion from analysts and gaming press that they thought this was going to be $399. That would have been great, but even super aggressive, an incredibly aggressive move. Even at $499, I feel like the compute power you get for this is pretty impressive. This is essentially an RX 580 GPU. So the question comes up, of course, can you Bitcoin mine with it or Ethereum mine with it? But, just kidding. That GPU itself is say it's $250. So now you're paying $250 for your CPU, your storage, the design, the power, all types of stuff. A PC for that with that much power is going to be more than $500. One of the developers came out, the developer of Arc, I guess it was, mm-hmm. that said, because it's in a console and because the operating system is streamlined and the API is streamlined, that the actual net performance you can get out of this machine is closer to that of a GTX 1070 than a GTX 1060. Which is interesting, right? And that's not Microsoft saying that. That's one of their developers. That kind of mirrors things that we have known about the console market for a long time, that because it's not as diverse of a multi-use system, everything is streamlined in a way that is better, right? So there's less overhead on the software side, and people can more directly access hardware. So I think it's pretty interesting that they would make that claim. Will you actually be able to run 4K games on this, native 4K? And Microsoft is definitely coming out there and saying yes. It's a little bit of a surprise for them. That's mm-hmm. obviously the marketing push you have to make. But Sony did that as well, and they had a 4 teraflop compute system on theirs. Right. But if you look at even today, as you sit there with somebody with a 1080 Ti that is a 10 teraflop compute GPU, it's hard to really make that claim of 4K 60 universally across flagship AAA game titles. Yes, there's a lot of games you can play at 4K with that, but it's tough. So it's not going to surprise me if a lot of the Xbox One X games or a lot of these games that claim 4K are going to run at 25 by 14 in scale or 1080p scale. And I don't want to say that as like an extremely negative thing, because I still think it's going to be, everything's going to look better than it did on the Xbox One or Xbox One S. But I think the idea that, oh, everything's going to run at 4K should be tempered somewhat.
How do you define 4K?
Just because.
Which
4K? Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it still has the 4K UHD Blu-ray player like the Xbox One S does, which is great. And it's still disconcerting that Sony didn't do that on their PS4 Pro. It'll output at 4K. So if you have a 4K screen, like the menus and everything will run and it will be smooth in that regard. But yeah.
The marketing. I don't know. We'll find out. It'll be very curious. It ships November. There will be a lot of noise around the time that comes out. Certainly, we will have glorious and detailed reviews on that one. Samsung announces a FreeSync 2 HDR display, or several FreeSync 2 HDR displays, includes the C49HG90 49-inch ultra-wide. And suddenly, my 34-inch ultra-wide seems so reasonable by comparison. I love that it's FreeSync. Have they talked about the cost on this? It's like $1,500 on Amazon in pre-order right now. Wow.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I mean, it's amazing, right? It's 32 by 9, which is ridiculously wide. It's an 1800R curvature, which means it's a fairly narrow radius. So it's going to feel like it's wrapping around you. And you may be looking at Windows boxes and being like, is that curved? And the answer is no, but the screen is, and the radius is so tight, you're going to notice it. 3840 by 1080. So the pixels are going to be a little big, especially after my recent 8K experience. But the big thing there is the refresh rate, peaks at 144 hertz. And this is, like a 1 millisecond rated response time. This is pretty killer. And then the CHG70, which is a 32 and a 27-inch model, which are 2560 by 1440 resolution, and selling at $599 and $699. And then there's a game mode. What does the game mode do?
I honestly don't know the answer to that yet. You wouldn't think a whole lot because it's already FreeSync. It's already 1 millisecond response time. It's probably something to do with overdrive capability would be my guess. Trying to do a little bit more aggressive overdrive to avoid ghosting and that type of stuff at high frame rates or high refresh rates. Lower refresh rates. But I don't really know. I want to reiterate that 49-inch monitor is essentially two 27-inch 1080p monitors side by side with no bezel in between.
Yeah.
Right? Because the resolution is 3840 by 1080, which is... So it's not as high resolution as I was kind of like picturing in my mind when you hear a 49-inch and you hear 3840, because it is very, very wide. And I don't have a picture of it on that post, but there are some pictures online I saw of this machine, of this with like sitting on a desk, right, to give you some sense of scale with like a keyboard sitting in front of it. And it's super wide. Like it's a big honking beast. And it's one of the first times where you look at it and you kind of go, hey, the curvature is actually necessary for this to really make sense, right? Because if you've ever had side-by-side 1080p's, chances are you angle them in a little bit, right? So that there's kind of where the bezel meets, there's an angle. I mean, I do that with my two 30-inch 25 by 16 displays sitting there. So with that, you definitely would need it. I'm curious to get my hands on one because it's HDR, it's FreeSync, and it's this incredibly interesting aspect ratio. I think we'll end up getting that's some idea of it. Keep in mind, even the 27 and the 32-inch versions of this are 144 hertz FreeSync VA panels, but they're FreeSync 2, which means they do HDR. That's what's kind of most interesting to me. And these are shipping at the end of this month. So this is I think it's the first like gaming HDR panels for PCs.
That's actually HDR.
Yeah. And I know NVIDIA has shown G-Sync HDR panels since CES, but they haven't really gone with any, you know, they haven't announced prices or release dates of any of their partners' products or anything yet. So this kind of gives FreeSync 2 the edge for the first time, I guess. Yeah.
For several minutes.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, that's a good way of putting it. For at least several minutes. It wouldn't surprise me if NVIDIA, you know, works with Asus or Acer or somebody and makes some kind of comparative announcement. Yeah.
Alienware, also at E3, couldn't get too close to these because there were a whole bunch of people around them when I wandered by, but Alienware has 240 hertz gaming monitors, the AW2518H running G-Sync and the AW2518HF, which is FreeSync. So we got a G-Sync monitor and a FreeSync monitor, which is awesome. It'll allow you to choose. I still dream of, you know, both specs being supported in one monitor, but I dream of a lot of things. But again, 240 hertz native, not overclocked. 24.5-inch 1080p TN monitor. So it's not going to be the most spectacular monitor visually unless you are dreaming of having all of the refresh, all of the fastest possible refresh you can get from your GPU. $700 for the G-Sync model. And the FreeSync model is $499.99. So $500, $200 less. June 13th are when those launched. What's with the $200 difference between those two?
I mean, that is the, you know, people call the Apple tax. That feels like a G-Sync tax, right? And this is one of the first times we've seen monitors launch at the same time that are identical spec'd, one being FreeSync, one being G-Sync, and there's a $200 delta between them. And you can, I mean, they do a little bit, like if you look at the visual design of the two, you know, left versus right, they're a little bit different. And I think NVIDIA just believes that their technology is better. They believe that their, you know, ecosystem is better, and so people will pay for that, right? And so it's hard. It's hard when you see, you know, these two things right next to each other, $699, $499, to kind of understand that as a gamer. Sure. And if people want to take NVIDIA up with that, then they buy a Radeon GPU and get the FreeSync display instead. Indy has another problem where you can't buy any of their new GPUs, but that seems unrelated to the FreeSync debate at hand. But
we're waiting patiently for them to ship.
For Vega, you mean? Yeah.
They did tell us back in May that it would be a while. So,
you know. Did. They certainly did.
They were honest. They were upfront about that, which I appreciate the heads up. Logitech. The G Power Play. This announcement has been growing on me because at first I was like, this is silly. And then I was like, this is actually kind of cool. It's the G900 mouse with a charging system that built into the mousing pad. Power Play's the name of the brand and the product that Logitech has launched, the wireless charging method makes it all happen. Wireless charging is something we usually think about with phones, not with mice. You don't have to like park the mouse in a certain place. Just as the mouse sits on the mat, it will charge. So I thought that was pretty cool. And I guess you can actually, they have two mice launching with the technology. You just leave them on the mat and they stay charged. There's a soft surface, hard surface. You know, they've got the power core module inside of there you can play around with. What's, are you excited for this? Am I alone in being kind of, you know, giddy about a self-charging mouse? Not that my mouse doesn't run out of power that often, but when it does, it's usually at the worst possible time.
I agree. Like, I thought it was pretty interesting. We've been asked about it for a long time as well, and it's just one of those things where I have the previous generation of this mouse that I use every day, the G900, and it's a high performance sensor, so it kind of loses battery more often than maybe a generic non gaming like standard consumer mouse would. Maybe, you know, every week or something like that is when it needs to be plugged back in. Now the G900 is already set up, so you plug in a cable excuse me, and you still can use the mouse, and you know, it's not that big of a difference. But if I could just never have to worry about that again, that sounds ideal. And this is where they get it. So I think it's great for that. But they also don't sacrifice anything else, right? So if you like the G903 and the G703 mouse that you buy to work with the PowerPlay wireless charging mat, still work fine as mice. If you do not have the PowerPlay mat, and if you, you know, take it with you on a trip or whatever, and you don't bring that mat with you, right? So you're not really losing anything with the mouse purchase. If you like the G900 and you like the G703 design, G903 and G703 design, like, you get that. Plus, if you want to spend an extra $99, which is admittedly a pretty high premium for a mouse mat, you get this capability. This is what a fantastic little marketing video there to like have infinite power, as they, you know, kind of dub it. Right. So, you know, it's interesting to look at it from a technical standpoint, where I asked them the question, if you had an empty mouse, if you had a completely drained battery on your mouse and I wanted to charge it up completely, how long would it take on a USB cable versus on the mat? And they said the difference was like 2 hours with the USB cable, 14 hours with the wireless charging. But as long as the wireless charging can provide enough power to the mouse that is greater than the amount of power it can use at any given time, then it's fine, which they say is absolutely the case. So
I should point out the power core module isn't like a weight or something you play around with. It's a magnetic module that attaches to the bottom of compatible mice that, if I'm understanding this, you know, allows is what kind of draws the charging through the PowerPlay wireless charging base.
Yes.
So I just want to make that clear. It's not a weight that you can play around with that, although this still has like,
well, the what they do give you is it's a compartment underneath the mouse that can either be a weight or it can be a rechargeable thing. So if you buy the G903 and you don't ever want to use the wireless thing, you can either leave that in there or replace it with the weight. Right. So it's just another option, but you can't use both the weight and the wireless charging at the same time.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
That seems to make sense. The, you know, in other Microsoft news, a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, there was a class action fight. Basically, Xbox 360 owners that said the discs were designed wrong and they were too easy to scratch. They were too easy to gouge. And in an 8-0 ruling, the U.S. Supreme Court on Monday, writes Reuters, ruled in favor of Microsoft Corp. Overturned a 2015 decision by the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. And it's, you know, it's an interesting situation, in part because it was such a hard-fought thing by this class. Basically, I assume the lawyers in this class action lawsuit. Quote, typically parties cannot appeal a class certification ruling until the entire case has reached a conclusion, but the Ninth Circuit allowed the console owners to voluntarily dismiss their lawsuit so they could immediately appeal the denial of a class certification, which led to Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who, you know, wrote on behalf of the court, quote, such a move is not permitted because a voluntary dismissal of a lawsuit is not a final decision and thus cannot be appealed. The approach sought by the plaintiffs would undermine litigation rules designed to guard against piecemeal appeals. Essentially the plaintiffs have to litigate their claims individually and get a final judgment before they can appeal. It's pretty crazy. Microsoft basically said, you know, less than 0.5% of Xbox owners reported disc scratches, and that it was misuse and that class certification was improper in that case. It's kind of a bizarre thing to see in the Supreme Court, and I just wanted to bring that up because it just, I guess, abused me would be the right word for
that. If this had gone through, I would have had so many new Disney DVDs coming my way from scratches from my daughter.
Xbox. DVDs, no.
I'm just saying we would have moved on to the next thing, right? We could have really taken it all the way.
One of the interesting things about having a lawyer as a neighbor, a couple of lawyers as a neighbor, is that you start to hear about things that are done in legal cases that are essentially done by lawyers or law firms to rack up billable hours and really have nothing to do with helping the client or seeking justice or making things super awesome better, and are often like contrary to what they should be doing. But the fact that they are figuring out ways to just keep billing, you know, and it's a little disheartening at times.
Yeah, I can understand that.
Yeah. Big story today. I believe you can talk about it now. We are after the release time. A little bit of something, something from Intel.
Yes. So, this is kind of an odd dissemination of information that they're going with here. They announced that Skylake X and Skylake SP. So Skylake X is the Core i9, Core i7 high-end X29 platform that's coming out next week from Intel. And the Skylake SP, which is their upcoming Intel scalable architecture, scalable processor line, have migrated away from using what was known as a ring bus architecture to a mesh architecture for inter-chip communication. So think of, you know, how does the Core 3 talk to Core 4, talk to Core 1, talk to the PCIe bus, talk to the memory bus, talk to, you know, L3 cache, like larger blocks of caches. And if you look at that diagram there, you'll see this is a fairly recent, I want to say this was the Broadwell E Xeon ring bus block diagram. And so you can see these different rings, and they facilitate communication between these devices. There's actually two rings going on that now communicate through different caches. So if a core on the right-hand side wanted to talk to a core on the left-hand side, they had to do intermediaries again. If the parts on the right-hand side want to talk to the logical blocks above the left, so you want to talk to PCIe interfaces, that type of stuff, you'd have to jump across again. It was getting very complex because of high core counts. Mm-hmm. And in order to keep the interchip communication and latencies at a reasonable level that they needed to keep performance at the point they wanted to keep it at, they were having to increase the frequency of this link, which increases power, which has, you know, negative side effects. So if you scroll down to the next diagram, you'll see what they're implementing now, kind of a version of what they're doing now, which is a two-dimensional interconnect, a mesh. It basically means that you can step between these logical blocks more quickly, and more consistently, right? So whereas with the ring, you know, you might have, it was literally like the ring bus, I would set an analogy to like essentially a city bus schedule, right? It goes in a circle and it makes a stop, and you can get on or off, data can get on or off, and then that message goes to wherever it needs to go and gets on or off there. And the buses went both directions, so you didn't have to go all the way around, but you always had to go, you could have to go at least half. Here, it's kind of a row column, two-dimensional thing where the communication can get where it needs to go a little bit faster. So the maximum latency is lower, though the minimum latency remains pretty much the same, maybe a little bit behind. And they used it to do some interesting things, like they readjust the cache this way. They can distribute the cache, when I say cache, the last level cache, so the cache that is kind of global for the entire die, can get distributed in equal size chunks along this mesh, so that on average, it will be less time for that L3 access from that particular core, right? And I say on average, I've emphasized that because there will be instances where it goes up and there will be instances where it's significantly lower. And if you want to talk to the cache on the core directly next to you, it's going to be, you know, one clock cycle. If you want to go to, you know, one in the top right, it's going to be three clock cycles, right? So there's differences like that. But it allows Intel to increase the bandwidth on their interconnect without drastically changing latencies, and in most cases lowering them. But also important is they're doing it with less power. So they're able to not have to worry about leakage of this very critical kind of communication component of their die. And though they didn't confirm it, I think that the mesh architecture does implement some die area disadvantages for them. When you're talking about a massive 28 core part or something like that, it's not really a concern for a little bit of die area for that mesh network. But this is just kind of, this will be the major architectural change that comes to the new Skylake X parts. So there you go. And it's worth noting that is different than what you have with Skylake consumer parts. Still use the ring bus, because when you're talking about four cores, the latencies and implications of the ring bus there mean very little compared to when you have 20 plus cores, apparently.
Apparently.
Yeah.
All right. Intel making changes to improve performance on their most complicated processors. I got it.
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. On a completely random note, if you are not up to speed, there is an eclipse coming August 21st. We're talking about this in pre-show. MrEclipse.com has a fantastic map, or a link to a fantastic map, on EclipseWise.com. Interactive, if you're a map nerd, interactive Google map that allows you to take a look at where the exact path is and the nearest place you can go see it. Should you have the desire to look up into the sky and see a, well, the sun missing. I've never seen an eclipse, so I'm... You know, me and the family are driving up to the middle of nowhere in eastern Oregon to go see this one.
I'm going to be honest. You kind of guilted me into, like, thinking I need to do this now. If you're driving 11 hours to go see this thing and I can go in, like, 2.5. Like, oh, all right. Because, I mean,
well, how often to be fair, do you get to see? Go ahead.
I was going to say, to be fair, like, no matter where you're at, you're going to see a partial eclipse, right? It's right. Do you want to experience the full eclipse, right? So even in Florence, Kentucky, you'll still see it partially occluded, but you don't get the full effect of this kind of, what is it, once every 60 years type of thing, I guess.
You know, I don't know how many chances I'll have to be this close to a full eclipse, so I
understand.
Going for it, man.
Yeah. So, like, this is a time where, don't you wish you had a buddy that had, like, a plane, like a Cessna or something that you could just kind of be up in the air during that time? That would be pretty awesome, right?
I have a friend of mine that's working on that, but he is also at the opposite end of the country and is not quite ready to, you know, spend a week flying out to pick me up and my family to go fly north. Plus, there's the whole, the children would love it. I don't know if my wife would buy into a small airplane trip. There's the door lock. I don't know if they have child safety locks on airplane doors. That could be entirely too exciting with the small children. Completely random thought before we go. Just when you thought Amazon couldn't come out with yet another Alexa product, they announced the Amazon Dash Wand with Alexa. $20. You get $20. Certificate or $20 off your next purchase after you register the device. It is essentially to allow you to super instantly fast order stuff from Amazon Fresh. A Wi-Fi enabled kitchen assistant that helps you shop Amazon Fresh and millions of everyday essentials on Amazon.com.
Is it actually shipping now?
In stock, ships and sold by Amazon.com. So,
because I think they announced this a while ago, and I thought it was like a joke at first.
No, it actually seems to be maybe they ship the Amazon Dash Wand and now they've added in Alexa to it, so you can scan an item, like scan the UPC
barcode on an item.
You know, it's supposed to be waterproof. It's magnetic to stick to your fridge, and you can say it's right there. Alexa, order paper towels. Alexa, press the button. How many teaspoons in a tablespoon? Press the button.
Now, do you need this? Okay, so the barcode scanner is the coolest part, because if you already have an Echo, you don't really need this, right?
Well, I would assume not, but you could wander around the house scanning things and adding them to your shopping list.
Do not give it to your 2-year-old to walk around and scan things. We already made this mistake. I have the what do they call the buttons? The Dash. Right. And yes. Before I had a child, I had ordered some of these, and I have one like by the garbage bags in the pantry. Yeah. And it's like, okay, if you take the last garbage bag out, hit the button, and 2 days later you have new garbage bags, whatever.
Right.
I've probably had 4 or 5 instances of garbage bags ordered not by an adult in the house. So now I have moved the Dash button up to a higher location to avoid this. And I probably should have done it after the first or second time, but you learn slowly, I guess, as a parent.
You know, the sleep deprivation slows down the whole learning process as a parent. At least that's my experience on that one.
Yeah.
My goodness. I just had to mention that. I'll order one. You'll probably order one.
Well, actually, I don't know if I can get Amazon Fresh here. I don't think I do. We do Amazon Prime now, but I don't think we do the Fresh, like the grocery specific. We do Pantry, which I think is different than Fresh, which I think is different than Prime now. Yeah, I think those are all separate services.
It's not getting too complicated, is it?
Yeah, no, not at all.
Oh, my goodness. You know what? I'm just going to close the Amazon window and not try to figure this out while we are recording. Oh, my goodness. Hey, you got a question about hardware? Do us a favor. Tweet at Ryan Schrouder, at Patrick Norton. If this is your first trip to Twitchland this week in computer hardware, please, this week in computer hardware, not the movies of a certain ilk, Die Harder. A timeless classic. The website to go to is twit.tv/TWICH. You can find more of Mr. Shrout over at PCPer.com. You can find me over at TechThing, TEKTHING.com, or AVXL.com. And we want to thank you for joining us for this episode of This Week in Computer Hardware. With that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Shrout.
We'll see you next week.